Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, ever get a song stuck in your head? Is that really possible? Or is it an urban health myth? We'll dig into the fact and fiction surrounding the earworm. Plus, does cracking your knuckles cause arthritis? We'll get the answers to both questions in our feature, Debunk or Detruth, coming up later.
But first, nobody wants to receive a diagnosis of cancer. But for those facing head and neck cancer, the challenges often involve changes in physical appearance, function, and quality of life. Treatment can offer survival, but may also result in difficulty speaking, swallowing, and breathing.
Here to discuss the symptoms, diagnosis, and treatment of head and neck cancer is Dr. David Pfister, Chief of the Head and Neck Oncology Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Pfister treats patients with a broad spectrum of head and neck malignancies, including tumors of the mouth, throat, thyroid, salivary glands, and skin. Welcome to Take Care, Dr. Pfister. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
What are the most common forms of cancer that appear in the head and neck regions?
Well, it's a very heterogeneous site. So generally when folks think about head and neck cancer, they think of tumors of what we call the upper digestive tract, which is the upper kind of areas in your mouth, in your throat, when you go on the mirror. Your voice box and so forth. So that is, again, among the most common sites. The other site that's quite common is that thyroid cancers are quite common. You know, in the head and neck area, you also have, because it's a sun-exposed area, you commonly get skin cancer. So we commonly see skin cancers in the area as well. But when you hear someone talk about head and neck cancer, sort of implicitly they're referring to when you read articles about it are tumors of the mouth, throat, what we call the upper digestive tract.
So when people say oral cancers, they're also referring to this region?
Also referring to this region, but within that head and neck region, the oral cavity would be a subsite.
So are the causes the same for most of these?
Well, historically, when you look at tumors of this head, neck, or upper digestive tract, focusing on that area, since the risk factors would be different, let's say for thyroid cancer, for example, or skin cancer where you think about sun exposure, historically, the main risk factors for these tumors have been tobacco and or alcohol use, and there seems to be kind of a synergistic risk with the interaction between tobacco and alcohol. And so this was one of the sites that of the body where really those behaviors were clearly associated with cancer. And I've been an oncologist now dating back to late 1980s, and that certainly early on in my career, that was the typical sort of risk factor description for head and neck cancers. What we've come to appreciate with time, though, is that there is a role for viral infection in this part of the body. We've appreciated this for some time for tumors of the nasopharynx, which is an area behind your nose that's sort of the upper part of the throat area. But more recently, over the last decade, what we've come to appreciate is there are certain subtypes of head and neck cancer which are related with infection with another virus called human papillomavirus. Many of the listeners may be aware of this, the human papillomavirus and its association with cervix cancer. But over the last decade, we really come to appreciate this association between human papillomavirus and head and neck cancer, specifically tumors in the part of the head and neck called the oropharynx, which includes, you know, basically when you go in the mirror and you go, ah, so it's your tonsils, your back of the tongue area.
We're going to get back and talk about the relationship with HPV and some of these malignancies. But I just want to ask a question that I'm curious about when I do my homework and find out with other cancers as well that alcohol and tobacco are a risk factor. And with tobacco, you can imagine that you might be taking in a carcinogen that's actually directly touching and in your mouth, on your tongue, and in your throat. But what is it about alcohol?
What's happening? Is it the process of drinking the alcohol, or is there something more going on? And I know we can't really quantify this exactly, but just out of curiosity, when we say alcohol, is there a certain number that really correlates with malignancy? So just describe how alcohol could cause these kinds of malignancies.
Any local irritative phenomena, like areas of chronic trauma or ill-fitting dentures, could potentially lead to cancer. So there may be sort of a local effect there. Obviously, one of the two risk factors, tobacco and alcohol, that we're particularly focused on tobacco because it's very difficult to look at tobacco consumption and identifying a redeeming value from a health perspective. You're probably familiar that with alcohol, that while it is associated with certain cancer, that moderate alcohol consumption may be associated with a positive effect on cardiovascular risk. So there may be a local sort of exposure irritating effect, but the other thing that may be the case, and you remember before when I talked about that there seems to be a synergistic effect between the tobacco and the alcohol, is that there may be some interaction between the tobacco and its ability to sort of facilitate the carcinogens kind of getting to where they need to go, that sort of leads to that synergistic risk. But when they look at the risk, they do these big epidemiologic studies, and they quantitate that risk based on, let's say, the some quantitative amount of tobacco consumption. So, is that risk as the amount of tobacco consumed that risk goes up? Similarly, when you look at the evolution of alcohol use and quantitating that alcohol use from, let's say, one or two drinks a day to more significant drinking, there also seems to be an increase in risk of head and neck cancers. And then the combination looks to be synergistic.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. We're talking to Dr. David Pfister. He's the chief of head and neck oncology service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
We're talking about head and neck cancers and possible causes. How is this usually found? Does the patient find it, or is it screened for? Describe that process.
Yeah, there's not a, unlike, let's say, for breast cancer or colon cancer or, let's say, cervix cancer with a pap smear, that we're still trying to find a good screening test for head and neck cancers. I'd say that in terms of when you look at national guidelines, it's not like there's a specific test. You know, I'd say that generally what I think most of the listeners and probably those of us talking right now, it's really so you go to the dentist, you look in the mirror yourself. So it's not like there's an established screen test, although there is a lot of work and research going on in this area, particularly in the context of most listeners will be aware of going to get a pap smear for a risk of cervix cancer, and cervix cancer seems related to human papillomavirus. So there's keen interest in perhaps finding some HPV-related screening tests that could potentially be applicable to head and neck cancer, although nothing's ready for prime time right now. I'd say that in terms of moving on there to symptoms, what do patients typically sort of present with? In my experience, generally it's the patient comes in with a complaint that then when I examine, I look around, that then I confirm something. But history is extremely important. So what are the sorts of complaints? It depends a little bit on where the tumor starts. So in the mouth, it may be an ulcer on the tongue that doesn't seem, you bit it and normally it would heal, but it's not healing. Sometimes when you've got that type of sore, it can bleed a little bit. So if you notice, oh, gee, there seems to be blood in my phlegm and I keep getting blood in my phlegm. As you get sort of back in the sort of more toward the back of the throat and toward the voice box, you can get this sense of maybe a foreign body sensation, a sense of pain. Sometimes that pain, because of the way the nerve network's laid out, can actually radiate from your throat area up to your ear. if the tumor gets a little larger, you can feel a sense, oh, gee, when I go to swallow, I used to be able to, it had no limitations when I ate, but now when I go to take like a big vitamin pill, it seems like it's getting stuck. If it's on the voice box itself, you know, commonly patients present with, oh, I have a change in my voice or hoarseness. If it presents sort of higher up toward the base of the skull area, sometimes people come in with headaches or even double vision, or that they have fluid behind the eardrum on the one side. That's something called otitis media, which is very common in kids, but it's not something you typically get in adults, and if you have it on one side, that's something that you need to follow up on. Another thing is that sometimes the primary manifestation of the tumor in the mouth or the throat isn't so clear-cut, but the patient knows there's a lump in the neck, and that what that lump is basically a spread of the primary tumor to spread to a lymph node neck. So if you have a new lump, it's certainly something you need to follow up on.
How is this treated? Because we are talking about sensitive areas, as you mentioned, the upper air and digestive tract, and there's also the voice box in some of these cancers. Does treatment always compromise function?
Well, I think that's a critically important question for the listeners. I think that the historically, these tumors, if you look at the evolution of cancer therapy, that the approach would have mainly been with surgery, and if it didn't really lend itself to surgery, it would be some sort of radiation or radiation as an adjunct to surgery. Now, if it's a small tumor and roughly a third of these patients will present with sort of earlier stage or smaller tumors, that operation is generally preserves function, shouldn't be that big a deal, and the cure rate is quite good. Probably ballpark roughly 60% of tumors, even though this is in the head and neck area, they commonly present with tumor that's either locally advanced or has spread to a lymph node in the neck. And consistent with the gist of your question, here when you go to operate on these areas, particularly if it's a tumor of the voice box, that surgery could potentially jeopardize the voice box. What's often underappreciated is that, let's say, you have a tumor that's in the back of the tongue area, that you might say, well, gee, they can operate on that, but it's not really going to affect my voice box. But the back of the tongue is very critical to speaking and swallowing. So actually, the functional and quality of life consequences there could also potentially be significant. I think that, and when I initially started as an oncologist in the late 1980s, a big thrust of my research really had to do with the development of new therapies that basically would preserve cure rates, but also preserve quality of life, function, and cosmesis. And really, when we approach head and neck cancers, and I think your question is very insightful, we, of course, want to cure the patient. We want the patient to live. We're obviously very focused on survival. But integrated with that as a partner that kind of moves forward with it is, how do we design a treatment plan that leads to the best possible cure rate, but at the same time optimizes quality of life, cosmesis, and function for the patient? And I think that in that regard, there's been a clear increase in the number of these patients that are treated with radiation-based treatments over the last decade or so, commonly combined with chemotherapy as a radiation sensitizer or facilitator radiation, which allows us to cure the tumor, avoid some of the anatomic and structural consequences of a big operation without compromising and cure rate. And I think that even within that package of chemoradiation, we've had significant advances in the way we deliver radiation so that we're able to target and optimally dose the area that has tumor, but avoid the dose to areas that are likely uninvolved with cancer, that treating them just lead to more side effects, of which probably dry mouth is among the most common side effect of radiation. So if they can design a radiation plan that spares significant salivary tissue, your function, quality of life is much better afterwards. At the same time, is this evolution. Our surgical colleagues have also advanced the bar in terms of curative treatment that preserves function. And in that regard, just to give a couple examples, is that if you go in, you need to cut the tumor out, that there are specific operations where they get the entire tumor out, but careful attention is paid to preserving key structures for function. Also, if there's a big defect, there are are different ways that they reconstruct those defects to preserve form and function. And finally, something that that maybe the listeners have heard about is that there's increasing use of robotic technology in surgery. And what that allows the surgeon to do is get access to areas which are anatomically kind of difficult to get to, but that with the robot, they can kind of slide in there in a way much more easily than the surgeon's hands can, and access and do operations without having to, let's say, split the jawbone to get access to those structures. So clearly, when this disease is limited above the collarbones, we treat these patients with curative intent. The cure rates, depending on the location and how advanced these, can be very good. And there are options to preserve function, cosmesis, that are both radiation-based approaches and also surgery-based approaches.
We don't have much time left, but we did discuss very briefly HPV-related head and neck cancers, the human papillomavirus. You alluded to it. Could you talk about it? Because it is on the rise, and it's one of those cancers that's a little bit tricky to talk about.
Yeah, no, I think it's is probably one of the most common questions I get asked. You know, when you look at head and neck cancers, and you look at over the last couple decades, as tobacco behaviors in our country, with people decreasing the amount of smoking, overall, you see these tumors tracking downward a little bit. However, the subgroup that's related to HPV is clearly tracking upward. And what we find is that these patients that get the virally related tumors, as I said, tends to be in the area called the oropharynx, which is the tonsils and the back of the tongue area. What we find is the patients tend to not necessarily have any tobacco or significant alcohol history, that they tend to be younger. They tend to have less other medical problems because they are haven't been smokers and they're younger. They actually have a cure rate, even when they have stage 3 and 4 disease, that is actually, we cure most of these patients. It tends to be more curable than patients that have more traditional tobacco and alcohol-related disease. There's keen interest, since we have the etiology, to look for ways to potentially either prevent it, and so in terms of antiviral-related therapies, but also in terms of decrease, let's say, the HPV vaccine, which is initially licensed for preventing cervical cancer and genital warts. It was initially just given to young girls. Now it's given to both young girls and young boys. And we're keen to see what impact the vaccination has on the incidence of these HPV-related head and neck cancers, since the subtype which causes the largest amount of throat cancers related to HPV is the same subtype that causes most commonly cervix cancer. If you know, once you already have the HPV cancer, the vaccine isn't really not of therapeutic benefit because you know you've already been exposed. It's really something that's a preventive maneuver. Also, to the extent that these HPV related cancers are related with certain lifestyle factors, obviously, you know, they can be spread by close mucosal contact. You know, that's something which, in you know, generally, when you look epidemiologically, it's potentially associated with oral sex and increased numbers of sexual partners. You know, that's another lifestyle factor that potentially could be considered in terms of decreasing risk.
Dr. David Pfister is chief of the Head and Neck Oncology Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. Thank you so much for helping us understand head and neck cancers.
It's been a pleasure to be here today. Thanks for having me.
For more information on head and neck cancer and Dr. Pfister, visit the Take Care webpage at WRVO.org. If you miss part of this interview and want to hear it in its entirety, podcasts of our show are also available at our website and on iTunes.
Coming up, are earworms real? And is cracking your knuckles bad for you? Find out the answers in our feature, Debunk or De Truth, up next. You're listening to Take Care on WRVO Public Media.